So it sounds like they were going to do it. And the risk of sending down one man, I mean, when you're going down to the moon, you got two guys talking to each other and deciding that, hey, I'm seeing this gauge, you better be careful. And then one guy's watching the gauges while the other guy's looking out the window, selecting a good landing spot. To have one guy do that, my goodness, is that a risk. And so Lunar Orbit Rendezvous is what you're suggesting that they had, and only one man going down. A very high risk of method from my point of view. Over to you for any comments on this, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
That's the paperwork that came out that I read about. I mean, it might be different. So that's not written in granite. But, you know, I did see their pictures of the... Well, you could bring that up on the internet. You can see pictures of what they plan on landing. And what we had was the way that... Yeah, I mean, you had like a pilot and co-pilot, you know, a commander and a pilot. Armstrong was the commander, and Buzz Aldrin was the pilot of the LEM. That's how they referred to everybody. You're thinking about Mike Collins flying around, they were all by himself. In the future, that won't happen. You'll have people going to the moon, and everybody will be going down, and you'll just leave the mothership flying around and unmanned. That was actually the plan in the Constellation that was canceled by Bush. So, that's kind of risky. Russians were probably willing to take that chance. Let me drop it. That, you know, land a man on the moon and bring him back safely. I mean, Kennedy wasn't even thinking two men. And we did it with two. We put two guys there. And by the time the decade was out, we sent Apollo 12 with Pete Conrad and Alan Bean. They landed on the moon before the decade was out. That was in 1969 as well. So we made Kennedy's prediction, or mandate, I guess you would call it at the time, really true. Back to you there.
A risky mission. Now, us going to Mars, I'm convinced is not going to happen. But going back to the moon, even that is hard to justify, as I see it, Paul. It took $31 billion of Apollo program, Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, to get to the moon. And a total of, what, 7 landings, 14 people, or is it 6 landings, let's see. 11, 12... 14, 15, 16, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. Yeah, six landings, 12 guys. So 12 Americans walked the surface of the moon, and it cost $31 billion. And in today's money, it's not going to be a hell of a lot cheaper. We'll have better hardware. But what would the motivation be to send human beings back onto the moon as opposed to unmanned vehicles? A lot of risk, a lot of ultraviolet exposure, a lot of cosmic ray exposure, a lot of solar wind exposure, a lot of exposure to solar prominences. Lots and lots of things can get you in a lot of trouble until you, let me drop it. And you can't just land on the moon and sit there. Each one of those lunar landings of the Apollo program was very carefully timed to be at a spot on the lunar surface, midway between daylight and dark. In other words, you could say either lunar-wise early morning or late afternoon, where the temperature was reasonable. The moon goes down to some ridiculously cold temperatures at night and ridiculously hot temperatures during the day. And the lunar day is 28 days long. So that you don't just land and walk around for a while. You can't tolerate those temperature extremes. So you've either got to have an extremely rugged habitat that can tolerate the huge temperature extremes, or you got to dig in below ground and establish something that's a whole lot of feet down where the temperature is much more stable. So how would you put a colony on the moon and sustain them? Let me drop it. Near the North Pole of the moon, you do have more even temperature day and night. That's the good news. But the bad news, I think the polar temperature is probably something like minus 100 degrees. Not very friendly. So to send anybody to the moon for any real duration, we send people there for 2 days at a time, at the early morning and late afternoon at the moon, for that particular place where you rest. You don't want a man there at high noon. You don't want a man there at midnight. In either case, I think there's almost no survival because of extreme differences in temperature. So I don't think it's an easy solution to that. Great science fiction about sending us back to a colony on the moon and live there for a while. Huge expense, huge difficulty. What do you get in return? Am I too negative on this one, too? I mean, even though it's 1,000 times easier than Mars, I'm not convinced we're going to send a colony to the moon, though, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I think it's going to either be a foreign country like China or even India. India has a manned program that they're thinking about very seriously. And so if not that, if not China, it's going to be a private company. For instance, Moon Express, within a year or so, you're going to see them send this private company. They'll actually land a vehicle on the moon and have it take off again and fly, you know, a couple thousand feet and land again. They plan on getting the $30 million X Prize from Google to do that. And you know, his long-term goal is to send people there. Now, long-term for, like you say, a colony, that means a lot of people. They have these lunar tubes, lava tubes, that are located on the moon. You can go in there and you can put a city in some of these things. They're huge. So, I mean, it's a good way to get out of the radiation that's being, you know, pumped on the moon every minute. And but I think that's a long way off, and a more immediate way of doing it, I think, would be, you know, what we'll see is this Bigelow Space Corporation. They're building these inflatable habitats, and once they find out you have reliability with these things in space, for instance, they plan on putting space stations together. They call them PA-300s. They're going to attach, in the beginning, they'll attach two of them together and be able to dock with it, most likely using either SpaceX or Boeing to dock with the little flying space station. That each one of these inflatable things are probably three times bigger than the Destiny module that we have on the space station. So you can put a lot of people in this thing. Long-term plans are to take these same inflatables and land them on the moon. And you can put a half a dozen of them, you know, as many as you want, together, create a large living space. Naturally, you're going to need tremendous heating, so they'll lay out solar panels, you know, probably the thousands of feet, tens of thousands of square feet of solar panels to create electricity, to create heat, and then to live through the two-week night cycle. I don't know, I think you're going to have, you're going to need really big batteries to charge up, from these solar panels, or you'll probably need some kind of nuclear RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, and a lot of them, because each one only produces, I think, 103 watts. They got a ways to go, but I think that's going to be the first thing you're going to see. Bigelow inflatables. And he's got really the okay from NASA to develop these things. The first test one is going to be launched this year by SpaceX, and it's going to be attached to the Tranquility node on the International Space Station. They're going to pump it up, and they're going to have another room up there for a minimum 2 years. It's a two-year experiment, see how it does, check the pressures, make sure everything holds, see how it holds up against micrometeorites. And they pretty much know it's going to work pretty good anyway, because he's already sent two of these things up on his own, launched by a Russian spacecraft called Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. and they're still flying around in orbit taking pictures. Not manned, but they were prototypes. Back to you, Dick.
I just did a quick Google search on lunar temperatures, and the temperatures on the moon can get as low as minus 238 degrees centigrade. Boy, that's uncomfortable. I haven't found the maximum temperature yet at high noon on the moon. I know it's much too hot for the astronauts. Now, in the case of a cold temperature, you can put a guy in a very well insulated suit and you pour some energy in it to create some heat. That's great. But if you're putting a guy in a temperature that might hit something really crazy like 130 degrees Fahrenheit, unless you've got an extremely good air conditioner and you're sure it's not going to fail, in a short period of time you're going to cook the guy. He's in an oven. So to put a man on the moon like we did for 2 days on each one of the Apollo missions, and he's halfway between midnight and high noon in a good place where the temperature is, let me pick a number, 65 degrees Fahrenheit. That's very nice, but you don't want to leave him there very long. If high noon is coming or if midnight is coming, in either case, he's going to be in extremely uncomfortable temperatures very, very soon. So you're not going to put a colony on the moon only for 2 days. If you're putting a colony on the moon and you're putting them in these, let me drop.
I have information about temperature.
Very good. So you're putting them in these habitats, and for the habitat to tolerate the cold and generate heat, I can sort of accept that. But what's the maximum temperature you get at high noon on the equator of the moon? I'm a little bit afraid that could be an awfully big number, because the moon is really approximately the exact same distance from the sun as we are. And that sunlight beating down at high noon on our equator is not too different than what happens when that sun beats down on the equator of the moon.
Dead Valley, how to spot, Dick?
I hear you. But here on the Earth, you've got continuous wind blowing that's at least to some degree controlling the temperature. So what we know, the moon can get some extremely cold temperatures. Have you found something that'll tell us what's the highest temperature you get on the moon, Wes? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, Wesley, okay, I was going to say 250. Either way, 250 up, 250 down is roughly the numbers, but I think you went over to Wes.
Okay, so you got it, 250 up and down.
100 degrees of Celsius, 100 degrees is about boiling water. Boiling water, and the maximum is 173 Celsius.
Okay, so I'm getting a confirmation. I'm getting a confirmation here of extremely high temperatures, boiling water temperatures at high noon, and ridiculous. So it looks like a poll has rounded us off as 250 high and 250 low, 250 negative, 250 positive. In either case, without extremely rugged hardware, you can't tolerate that. To put a man in the temperature of, let me pick a number, 150 degrees centigrade, not even with good air conditioning would I trust that. A slight hiccup of that air conditioner and you're going to be baked. So whenever someone talks about these habitats that you just mentioned, Paul, and they talk about putting a colony of human beings on the moon, do they completely forget about these temperature extremes? Are they glossing over that? WS2N, K2RIW.
One more. 392 plus and minus 328 Fahrenheit.
Big numbers. Hey, Paul, do they mention any of the tolerance of that when they talk about these habitats and they talk about colonies? Do they completely forget about temperature? Over to you, Paul.
You're going to have to bring, there's no cows on the moon. You're going to go on and on, Dick. You got to supply these people with food. It's endless. Yeah, you could take the water that they found in the craters and make oxygen, you can make even hydrogen for fuel, and you could do all that. But you got to eat something, you know. And I think that's part of the biggest problem. And you don't want any kind of air conditioning or heating breakdowns. But we sent them to the moon. I think the longest stay was 3 days on Apollo 17 with Cernan and Harrison Schmidt. He was the scientist. And, you know, you think about the power that they bought with them. They're sitting up there with battery power, Dick, for 3 days. No. That's all they had. They didn't lay out big acres of the solar panels, or they had some solar panels for the test units that they put out, the Atlas units. But you know, and what's amazing when you're at the aviation. I've seen this before. You know, I've seen the size of the limb, but when you stand next to the thing, that's a big thing. You know, from pad to pad. You know, diagonally it was 37 feet thick. That's a big thing. It's much larger than the command module. When you look at the command module, it's a big, big difference. Back to you.
There was supposed to be a Apollo 18, which got canceled, and that lunar module built by Grumman, I think, is the one that is now sitting at the Cradle of Aviation Museum on Long Island. And when you look at that thing, that's what I think you're describing. It is an extremely large thing. I mean, those legs had to be folded up real fancy in order to squeeze inside of the covering so that it could get through the atmosphere. Silder, I think it's pronounced. So I think the one that's at Cradle of Aviation is not a mock-up. I think it's the real thing. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
About the command module, right?
I was talking about the lunar module. The lunar module at Cradle of Aviation, I think, is the real thing. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, they had an extra one that never went. And then they also had a command module there as well. And very, very good job at what they did. But yeah, you can't get past it. You know, they have it roped off. You can't get in there and start climbing on this thing. But yeah, that's supposed to be a real one. They have it all, you know, with the foil and everything. They boil over it the way the original one looked. But they do have an original man module too that's sitting there that they use for a test. Actually, they used it for an escape test. That one was not planning on going to the moon, the one that's there. But it's one that they used for the test. They do have actual parachutes that came back. They do have that hanging up. Back to you, Dave.
When it comes to the size of the lunar module, run this by again. I think you're telling me that the tripod pads that touch the lunar surface are 37 feet apart? I mean, the diagonal distance across my living room is 22 feet. To me, that's a big distance. 37 feet? Is there any slip of decimal points here, Paul? Are those pads, triangular pads, 37 feet apart? WS2N, K2RIW?
Pads, four legs. Yeah, 37 feet. If you go diagonally, you know? So that's the biggest length. Naturally, that was all folded up, fit inside the cowling of the S-4B, the second stage. Top of that, you had the limb, and they had these legs folded up, and over 1,000 pounds of force on the legs. They had these big, like, leaf springs that were, you know, pushing on it. And they had pyrotechnics go off, which cut the titanium straps that were holding the legs pop out. And yeah, that would be the distance, you know, end to end, you know. So I mean, when you look at it, you're standing next to it. It looks big, you know, between the upper stage and the lower stage. It's a big thing.
You did say it's a square of four pads, and the diagonal distance is 37. And whenever you've got a square, diagonal distance versus the side of the square is 1/√2. That's 26 feet. So pad to pad, the shortest distance, 26 feet. Diagonal across the four pads, 37 feet. Wow. I'm comparing. doing that to my house. And it's a good fraction of my house, if you know what I mean, in ground area. And I've got a medium-sized ranch house. That's a lot of stuff. And sitting on top of it is the actual thing where they sat in. And in order to make it light enough, I remember Buzz Aldrin saying that, let me drop it. The aluminum on the side was almost paper thin. That they were concerned a little bit that if during sleeping at nighttime, if somebody had kicked his foot real fast because he's having a nightmare, there's a chance he could kick a hole in the side of the lunar module, and it would be game over. They'd be instantly in a vacuum. So this is a maximum efficiency item, made as light as you could make it, just barely strong enough, and these dimensions, wow. When we see the pictures, when we see the operation, you get the impression it's small. But I vaguely remember seeing it in real life at Cradle of Aviation, and it's certainly large. Did you also say that a command module, or maybe Apollo 18, is there a command module, the real thing, not just a backup, is that also at Cradle of Aviation? Let me drop it. There I'd be a little bit more skeptical. So for the lunar module to come back to Long Island, where it was invented and produced by Grumman, I can see that. But Long Island didn't manufacture the lunar module. Therefore, the guy who manufactured it, Rockwell or whoever, of course they're going to scream and holler that, hey, the one that's left over has got to go to our local museum. So if there's a lunar module on Long Island, I'm left to believe it's either one that came back from space, or it's a mock-up. So do we have a real lunar module at Cradle of Aviation? WS2N, K2LAW?
A real LEM, but the command module, that's different. I know you're asking about that. And there was no official Apollo 18. I mean, you had Apollo Soyuz mission where they docked up in space. You had an Apollo spacecraft go on that. Some people like to call that Apollo 18, but it wasn't. Then you had three other flights after that where they used Apollo command modules. And they were the three that went to the Skylab. But the one in Cradle of Aviation is one that they used on a test vehicle out in out in White Sands. I forget where they launched that from. And they launched it to make sure the parachute's open and all. But that was a test vehicle, and that's what they have at Cradle of Aviation.
Fantastic. The mission was always planned at the lunar dawn, DAWN, so the maximum and minimum temperatures were never experienced. Because of the rotation of the moon.
Yeah, the nice thing about the moon is it does its rotation on its axis once every roughly 28 days. Let me think now. In 28 days that we see, but we're also going around the sun at the same time. So therefore, the actual lunar day is probably close to 27 days long. So because the lunar day-night is 27 days, you can choose 2 or 3 days in which you put an astronaut in just the right spot, where he's midway between high noon and midnight, so to speak. He's at the early morning or late afternoon. And so, in the case of Apollo 17, which was there for 3 days, according to what Paul just told us, I'm guessing the first day was a little bit cold and the last day was a little bit hot, if you know what I mean, because the temperature is either continuously changing by increasing or continuously changing by decreasing, depending on where you land. Were you landing in a place where it was early morning, or were you landing in a place where it was late afternoon? Do we know that, Paul? I mean, crazy details we're getting into here tonight, but it's kind of fascinating. We never... Let me drop this. Everybody who thinks that you send an astronaut down to the moon's surface and you leave him there for a length of time dependent on consumables. How fast is he chewing up the oxygen and the fuel and the food? In reality, there's a much bigger determining factor. How fast is the moon at that? How fast is the lunar surface where you are either getting hot because high noon is coming, or getting cold because midnight is coming. In either case, you're not going to be there very long because those temperature extremes are out of sight, intolerable by my standards. And so, to send a colony to the moon, and we worry about, you know, are they going to find water fast enough and oxygen fast enough and whatever, is a much bigger factor. That first lunar day, what in the world kind of a habitat do you put them in so they can tolerate those extreme temperatures and the cycling of that temperature during the first lunar day? I don't see a way you can get past that first lunar day, Paul. You can't land there with a perfect habitat that is, let me pick a number, 50 feet below the surface of the moon where the temperature is a little bit more steady. You can't do that on the first day. WS2N, K2RW, I'm not convinced we're going to send them to the moon, Paul.
Yeah, Buzz Aldrin has a good book. Is it Mission to Mars? His version, you know, and he talks about all the what you could do by going to the moon and, you know, different things. Eventually, he gets to the Mars story, but one of the things is you could construct habitats on the moon without people down there. Have them do it robotically, and maybe you could have somebody in there. In the L2 position or something, or L4 position, and, looking down at the moon and operating the controls, and, you know, do things like that remotely before you send people down. Get it all set up, get the infrastructure set up, and then go down there and do what you got to do. By the way, the size of it, think about the, you know, the side of the limb. They opened up a lanyard, and out came this car, this lunar rover built by GM, you know, and it unfolded, and they climbed in and drove around, you know, for days on end. So you can imagine how big that limb is to hold a little car. I mean, the car was not big, but it was still a good size to put two people on there and drive it around. You know that, Dick. You looked at it real close. I think you said you even sat in one. And it just... It's a big contraption, and you know, this came from outer space, out of orbit, had a deorbit, had a 10,000 pound thrust engine to land it onto the moon, and then eventually it had to take off and leave the first stage behind as a launching platform. So it was basically a two-stage rocket. Incredible, incredible size, and it weighed over 30,000 pounds. I think 35,000 was the latest version. Let me drop it. The version of later miles were around 35,000, 37,000. So, you know, you take 15 small cars, 15 small Hondas or Toyotas, and put them together and land them on the moon, and it gives you an idea of the weight and the size of this thing. I mean, it wasn't made of lead. Back to you, Dick.
I have something. The equatorial temperature depends how far you are from the equator. Is roughly plus or minus 2 Earth days from the lunar noon. So that would be at 60 degrees, the temperature would be 58 degrees of Celsius, which is half of the temperature of the boiling water at Drexia.
Which is much too hot for human habitation. But you're right, Paul. I did sit on a lunar rover car at Houston, roughly 1972, and... by my standards, it was a very large go-kart, much bigger than your ordinary go-kart, front to back, side to side. Two astronauts in these great big bulky spacesuits can sit in that thing side by side. So, yes, that's a big vehicle, and that's just one of the objects that, as you said, hung on the side of the lunar module. Really big object. 26 feet across the square of the pads and 37 feet diagonal. Is the distance on the ground of the pads. That's a big thing. And you just told us 37,000 pounds. And that's just a fraction of what got launched that went down to the moon and came back. In fact, not all of that came back. The base of that, which is called the launch pad, I guess, that stayed. And so the actual final little thing that came back, what was that about? About 15,000 pounds came back, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, came back up to Lunar Robin.
That's good. Good thing to research. Now I don't know. I don't know. I would say probably. Yeah, that's probably the right number. Maybe a little bit less, if I had to guess. But I don't know. But you know, over half of it stayed there, and I was to get them down there. So fascinating. What went on back in late 1960s and into 1972. Yeah, with Lem, built right here on Long Island. Pretty cool. And interesting place to visit. Anybody gets a chance to go. Yeah, the X-43, which was involved with Ron Cockermer and some company out here that was involved with that. The X-43 is like a scram engine, you know. Got up to Mach 7. Got the record for the fastest thing to fly in the atmosphere. No people on board, but, you know, they got it. Very interesting. And naturally, they go way back, you know, to the early days of flight. But naturally, my favorite section was the space section. They got a lot of stuff on the shuttle. You know, Long Island was involved with building the wings on the space shuttle. Back to you, Dick.
I found something good. At the equator, it's 23 degrees centigrade, which is like summer in Poland. And during the night time goes to minus 24 degrees of Celsius, which is like in Poland. And to again.
So are you saying, Wes, that the maximum temperature at high noon on the moon at the equator is only 23? Only 20. I think it's higher than that, Wes. Go ahead.
I'm going to read it, and I have a link for it. So the equator, the temperature is about 290 Kelvin, or comfortable 23 degrees of Celsius, which is not hot in Poland. Breathe yourself sufficiently. At 60 degrees, drops to 249 Kelvin or minus 24 degrees Celsius. The average shop service temperature near the poles is 85 degrees. At 85 degrees and higher would be somewhere below 160 Kelvin, which is minus 110 degrees. So at 23 degrees is actually very much comfortable. I wonder where the astronauts have landed. If that is by you guys.
Okay, so lots of crazy temperatures as I see it. Not easy to tolerate. And so sending a colleague there. The words roll real easily, but to really send a colleague.
Yeah, I have a comment about your R7000. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Go right ahead, Joe.
You mentioned that you had a problem with your receiver. Did you ever measure that across the entire spectrum from 25 to 1,000 meg? Is it the same sensitivity or did it drop? Because I bought the same receiver, and after using it for a couple of years, I found out that it had a degradation getting around 550 to 650 meg. And it turns out what happens is some caps go bad in this thing after a while. Big affection sensitivity. I sent mine to the back of the factory. They changed all the caps and retuned it and did whatever else I had to do with it. The radio has been good ever since. Have you got the same problem with yours?
I believe mine is very low in sensitivity on all the VHF frequencies. I haven't done a careful measurement, but I am guessing I'm going to find out from 25 megs to 1,000, where it does use that low noise front end. I think it's a dual gate FET transistor. I was told that that transistor is very subject to failure and needs a replacement or a complete refurbishing of not using that exact same device. I know what the machine does when it goes from 1,000 to 2,000. It throws another mixer in front, and or is it downrange? I'm not quite sure. So I own a good enough signal generator where I can make the measurement of its real sensitivity. I know that it only behaves correctly when I put a 20 dB gain advanced receiver research preamp in front of it, Joe. Barefoot, the thing, if I had to make a guess, I'm guessing it's got a sensitivity of 5 microvolts as opposed to 2/10. I think that I'm going to look at the manual when I get a chance. I think the schematic shows that that preamplifier is used throughout much of the VHF region, and it's that preamp that I think has failed. You think it's something else? You think it's just going out of tune? W2RYY, K2RIW.
Yeah, take a good known good signal generator, get good output across the whole spectrum, and just measure like it, like 30 meg, 60 meg, 100 meg, 150. Go like every 50 meg. From starting at like 25 meg, you know, go up from 20, 25, 50, 100, so forth like that, even if it doesn't go below 25. And see if you start noticing a moderate change in sensitivity, because that might indicate the same problem I have with mine. Because I heard about this a long time ago. I've had the radio for like about 20 years. And they said that, from what was told to me, that there's some caps that go bad in the power supply, and they affect the tuning voltages of the rack tuning. That sets the sensitivity for the different bands you go to, even though it's got continuous tuning in it. When I sent it back to the factory, the guy in the factory told me too, because I talked to him on the phone. And then refurbished the radio, came back to me, and it's been working fine ever since.
Now that's brand new information to me, Joe. You made it sound like it's got a tracking RF front end. Now, the only other receiver I ever remember having that is the Yaesu 221R. It did have a tracking RF front end. I know that the R7000 is extremely good on image versus real response, because it's either dual or triple or maybe even quadruple conversion. I thought it was the good selection of the conversion frequencies that got of the response. You made it sound like there's a tracking RF end. And does that track all the way down to 25 megs and all the way up to 1,000? What do you think, Joe? WE2RYY, K2RIW?
I believe it does. I have the service manual on the radio. I believe it does, because I started trying to go through these alignment of the thing, and I, as I come by the different alignment points, I couldn't get the tuning voltages to be correct. They tell you to put the dial frequency on a certain dial frequency after you make sure the oscillator is set right, you know, the master oscillator is set correctly. And when you try to get these voltages on these certain frequencies, it was way out of whack. And I called the factory, and the guy in the factory told me what I had heard elsewhere, that the caps can change in the radio. They can change their performance and affect the tuning voltage. Yeah, this is a quad conversion radio. It has four IFs in the radio, four IF or IF frequencies. It's a quad conversion type of radio. That's what gives the thing very, very good image rejection and so forth. But to maintain sensitivity across the whole band to make it work as well as it does, it does, I believe, use a form of track tuning across the whole band. So you try that, and you bring it up as a subject next week, and let's see what you find out.
Hey, you bring up a very good point, Joe. I just happen to own a Hewlett-Packard 8640, a signal generator, which I think goes from 10 megs to 512, and I've got the converter that brings it to 1024. So I've got a good calibrated SIG gen, 10 megs to 1024. Therefore, I can do that test. Now, in order to confirm that the tuning voltages for the Varecta diodes that do the RF tracking are wrong, it'd be nice if they supplied a graph that says that when you tune it to 100 megs, the voltage on these reactor diodes should be this voltage. And if you're making the measurement with a good digital voltmeter that's got 10 mega ohm input impedance, then you should be able to confirm that voltage. So if the capacitors fail, and maybe they're tantalum capacitors, and they in turn are producing the raw voltage that gets modulated as a function of frequency, I can see how that could happen. However, you would think it's the exact same voltages that's swinging the voltage-controlled oscillator that makes the main dial work. I've had no trouble making it go to the desired frequency. So the voltages that tune the Varecta diodes of the voltage-controlled oscillator for the phase lock loop, that seems to be working like a charm. Back to you, Joe, W2RYY. Thank you for the info. K2RAW.
Well, it's done in segments because it's been a long time since I opened up the radio. But if you have the original tuning manual, the original service manual for that radio, go through there and just read it to see what I'm talking about. Because there's about four or five or maybe even six frequencies you set the radio to and make sure the tuning voltage is at the test point they're indicating in the procedure, the service procedure. You have to get a certain voltage very precisely at those frequencies. It's pretty precise. It's got to be, you know, within about a tenth of a volt of what it's supposed to be, because it does affect the front end sensitivity. And that's what's telling me when you said you have to put a preamp in front of the thing, it tells me something inside the radio isn't working right. Now, if it's flat across the whole spectrum, 25 to 1,000, it might be what you said. You might have blew something out in the radio. But if it has like a dip in the sensitivity like mine had when it approached about 550, 650 and going further up, it was something like about 5 to 10 microvolts in sensitivity, which would explain something being out of whack as far as the front end tuning.
What I have experienced, Joe, is that the lack of sensitivity at 2 meters, 146 megs, and the lack of sensitivity at 450 megs is about the same. It takes 20 decibels of preamp in front of either 146 megs or 450 megs in order to bring it up to full sensitivity. So in my case, it doesn't look like it's a sliding error of voltage on the Varecta tuning for the RF tracking. Now, if the thing changes its voltage as a function of tuning, how does it do that? Is there the equivalent of an analog to digital converter in there that's doing that? In other words, when you select a particular frequency, does it go to a lookup table and then has a digital to analog converter that creates that voltage? How does it do that, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW?
Well, essentially, yes. It works something like, like an example, commercial Motorola radios. You might buy a radio from Motorola that works with VHF or UHF, and when you set the radio up in a service alignment, you align the RF front end in different segments. Like, say, you might start at 450.025 and work these ways up every 5 or 6 megahertz in segments. And you'll set this slider in the software tuning, which basically sets the Varecta tuning voltage on the front end to be, you know, for the best sensitivity. In their case, they're telling you set it to this voltage for it to be correct in its operation. So the first thing to do is check it with an accurate signal generator before you even take a screwdriver to the radio and try to measure something inside. If your sensitivity is worse across the whole band, like you said, it might be the front-end transistor you're talking about that just simply knocked it out for the whole entire spectrum of 25 to 1,000. But if it's not, and you find that it changes moderately between low frequencies to high frequencies at UHF, might be what I'm talking about.
Comment? Keep good information. A person with comment, start off with your call letters, name, and then go right ahead, sir. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
Hey, just before we run out of time here, just a quick space comment. Live streaming, you can relying on water in the universe. Just Google it, Asimov Debate 2015. You can Google that, and you can get live streaming audio and video.
Very fine, Mike. Good stuff. Asimov Debate 2015. Okay, so we're essentially out of time. This was TechNet number 1553 of the series. We'll be back next week discussing space, ham radio, propagation, the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. And I'm going to have some questions for you guys. I bought the latest issue of the ARRL repeater manual, repeater guide, and there's some other modes of radio in there that I've never heard about. I'm going to be asking you guys some questions about that next week. Be kind to each other. Let me pass it over to John, KC2WGB, K2RAW. Go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yep, great night. I want to thank everybody for joining us and having some fun. And well, everything goes well, we should be here next week. Back to you, Dick, and have fun. KC2WGB.
Comment and one whitey white.
Go right ahead, Mike.
Dick, could you give me an email? I need to talk to you about something.
Yes, I can. First of all, you go to QRZ.com, I'm listed. I'm easy to find. I'm also listed in the phone book. N1YDY. That's Hank. I got you confused. Okay. You want to discuss something, Hank? By the way, if you're up at this time, you want to try a twisted pair right now?
Yeah, we could do that. Are you comfortable giving out the number in the air?
Yes, I am. 631-423-1963. And it's a listed number, so anybody could have found me. 631-423-1963. QSL?
423-1963. QSL, N1YDY. I'll catch you in a couple of minutes.
Roger, Dodger. Bye-bye for now. See you guys later. K2RAW clear.
Check your email. This is KGUPS. I sent you an interesting photograph. I'd like your take on how you think that piece of equipment got that way. So, just take a look at your inbox. I'll talk to you later. KGUPS.
Roger, Dodger, Rich. I'll go look. And thank you. You sent me some real good stuff in the past.
Watching some videos, trying to
Repeat again the information about anything about radioactivity, anything about techniques and instruments. I'm trying to listen to your advice. Don't buy anything grizzly. Want that liquid nitrogen generator? Just say for it. The temptations are incredible. And to exit.
Well, you know, it depends on what you're interested in. If you see something that you have to have, you know, of course buy it. But, you know, if you could hold off, you could acquire your nitrogen generator a lot sooner. But, hey, you can play that by ear, sure.
Canberra, there is a brand new Canberra for a few $1,000. it's a Rolls Royce of Canberra, so it's the top of the line MCA motor general analyzer, and yeah, it's tempting. So far 10 people are watching and nobody wants to risk the money. The guy wants close to $6,000.
Yeah, I think you said you were going to offer him 4, so make him some kind of an offer. You know, a little lower, and see what he says. Especially if nobody's... You got 10 people watching, but nobody's doing anything. Interesting.
It's expensive. I mean, people don't jump on things, especially exotic things like this, so very often. Yeah, I made him an offer of $1,500. Turned down that offer. The guy, I told you, is 6,250 something off sales. He's experienced. He knows what he's doing. Although, not necessary, because the guy is mostly camera seller, photographic equipment seller, whatsoever. But the guy is, yeah, long in the market. And he was doing business for many years, I believe. And, I have gone to his history. I see that there are a few items he sold, but he's selling it again. So he sold to himself. Yeah, there was another camera. It's also listed, but it was sold. So, yeah, maybe not that experience in this area.
Well, if he sold 6,000 items, yeah, he's a player, for sure. So, offer him $3,000, see what he says.
Well, I just made him an offer a few days ago, $1,500, so if I go for 3,000, it would be like I'm in rush. I don't believe it's good to do it now.
Okay, well, you know better than I, so whatever you want to do. But I don't know why you want to buy one of those things. You haven't been using the ones you have. So what's the advantage, you know? Makes me wonder.
Oh, I've been using that what I have. Oh, I'm playing with all of this stuff. Not a big time, but yes, I'm playing with this stuff. The concentration that I've got was because I've got those toys from government contractor, and I'm playing with it. Today I discovered that I have a 5 memorized on the vector analyzer, 5 memorized calibrations. So when I go to recall, I can go to either one of them, press the recall, for that particular calibration, it goes there. So now I know everything about this device. First calibration ever was done in 2008. Gosh, John, this thing must be much older. The first calibration was done in 2008. The last one was done in January 6, 2012. No, I'm sorry. The first calibration was done at January 6, 2011. So it looks like it was purchased probably a long time before. It was sitting in the pile, and
those guys are big, right? And then they start to use it, and they use it only one frequency range. And that is, hold on. ...1200 megahertz to 1400 megahertz. And to exchange.
Yeah, well, that's probably what they were working at on a particular project. So, yeah, that's common. Sure. That could be. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I told you, I think four or five calibration memories. And I think one is a... one is basically the original. I think the fifth memory is the original from HP. But that can be changed to, through the programming.
A question for you. I didn't know that Luckis was making his radars on such low frequencies. Do you know some of the... No, it's not old. It's 2011, John. Yeah, this thing must be from 90s. Should be from 80s. How old the device is?
I believe they started making them in 91, if I'm not mistaken. But that line was carried for a while, maybe up to 97. My date was 97. Not sure, but it doesn't matter. They worked fine. Perfect. Yeah, radar. They had radars covering all frequencies from 400 megahertz up.
Yeah. So when you go to Europe, you also had the memorized frequencies? I mean, memorized calibrations?
Yeah, sure. And I eliminated them all and refurbished with brand new calibration, with verification kits, recalibrated all of it, and basically wound up the same parameters. Yeah. They don't move much. They're pretty solid.
Okay. In presets, I have a factory preset, not modifiable. So this one cannot be modified. Then I have... The 1, 2, 3, 4, it starts from the REG, regular one, and then it says full, so for two channels. Preset 201, October 11, 2012, time 14:39:22. So, probably it was like, if they use it, okay, from 2011 to 2012, okay, not even 14. The last calibration, January 6th, October, okay, October 11, 2012, at 14:35:39. That's all. Yeah, these guys, they have a plenty of money at the HDN.
Yeah, plenty of money and they have plenty of instruments. They may have never been used. May have been used once. Never know. You know, they can afford it. But also, there's the capability. You have to look at the verification numbers that they put in there, what kit numbers, if they put that information in, to make sure they were 50 ohm, because that unit, I believe, is similar to mine. You can go 50 or 75 ohms. You can terminate either one. You just have to program it for it.
I didn't go that far. I believe it's only 50 ohm, but may be wrong. Did you ever deal with Luckis?
What's that?
Did you ever deal with Luckis?
Luckis?
Luckis. You said that they have branches all over the U.S. Lockheed Martin?
Oh, Lockheed Martin? Yeah, Martin Marietta, Lockheed Martin, sure. Yeah, I've dealt with them.
Yeah. Well, all I can imagine is that how they probably got in a new equipment again. So probably the range of the vibrators they didn't we've also changed. Yeah. You know how those flat moving dishes, if I can call it dishes, looks like.
I don't know what you mean by flat dishes. But don't forget, they don't only deal with radar. They have receivers and transmitters and stuff like that, so those frequencies are very common. And, you know, another thing, it could, maybe it wasn't a bench instrument. It may have been a service instrument that went out in the field. They may have had